Wolf Hall, Disc 17.
Saturday evening. Supper at Austin Fry's for Stephen Vaughan, so often in transit. William Butts, Hans, Kratzer, call me Risley. Conversation is in various tongues, and Rafe Sadler translates adroitly, smoothly, his head turning from side to side. High topics and low, statecraft and gossip. Zwingli's theology, Cranmer's wife. About the latter, it has not been possible to suppress the talk at the steelyard and in the city. Vaughan says, "Can Henry know and not know?" "That is perfectly possible. He is a prince of very large capacities." "Larger by the day," Risley says, laughing. Dr. Butt says, "He is one of those men who must be active, and recently his leg is troubling him, that old injury. But think, is it likely that a man who has not spared himself on the hunting field and in the tilt yard should not get some injury by the time he is the king's age? He's 43 this year, you know, and I should be glad, Kratzer, to have your view on what the planets suggest for the later years of a man whose chart is so dominated by air and fire. By the by, did I not always warn of his moon in Aries, rash and hasty planet, in the house of marriage?" He says, impatient, "We heard very little about the Aries moon when he was settled with Catherine for 20 years. It is not the stars that make us, Dr. Butts. It is circumstance and necessita, the choices we make under pressure. Our virtues make us, but virtues are not enough. We must deploy our vices at times. Or don't you agree?" He beckons to Christophe to fill their glasses. They talk about the Mint, where Vaughan is to have a position, about Calais, where Honor Lyle seems more busy in affairs than her husband the governor. He thinks about Guido Camillo in Paris, pacing and fretting between the wooden walls of his memory machine, while knowledge grows unseen and of itself in its cavities and concealed inner spaces. He thinks of the Holy Maid, by now established as not holy and not a maid. No doubt at this moment sitting down to supper with his nieces. He thinks of his fellow interrogators. Cranmer on his knees in prayer. Sir Perse frowning over the day's transcripts. Audley, what will the Lord Chancellor be doing? Polishing his chain of office, he decides. He thinks of saying to Vaughan, below the conversation, "Was there not a girl in your house called Yenica? What happened to her?" But Risley breaks in on his train of thought. "When shall we see my master's portrait? You have been at work on it a while, Hans. It is time it came home. We are keen to see what you have made of him."
"He is still busy with the French envoys," Kratzer says. "De Danteville wants to take his picture home with him when he gets his recall."
There is some laughter at the expense of the French ambassador, always doing his packing and having to undo it again, as his master commands him to stay where he is.
"Anyway, I hope he does not take it too quick," Hans says, "because I mean to show it and get commissions off it. I want the king to see it. Indeed, I want to paint the king. Do you think I can?"
"I will ask him," he says easily. "Let me choose the time." He looks down the table to see Vaughan glow with pride like Jupiter on a painted ceiling. After they get up from the table, his guests eat ginger comfits and candied fruits, and Kratzer makes some drawings. He draws the sun and the planets moving in their orbits according to the plan he has heard of from Father Copernicus. He shows how the world is turning on its axis, and nobody in the room denies it. Under your feet, you can feel the tug and heft of it, the rocks groaning to tear away from their beds, the oceans tilting and slapping at their shores, the giddy lurch of alpine passes, the forests of Germany ripping at their roots to be free. The world is not what it was when he and Vaughan were young. It is not what it was even in the Cardinal's day. The company has left when his niece Alice comes in, past his watchman, wrapped up in a cloak. She is escorted by Thomas Rotherham, one of his wards who lives in the house.
"Never fear, sir," she says. "Joe is sitting up with Dame Elizabeth, and nothing gets by Joe."
Does it not? That child perpetually in tears over her spoiled sewing. That grubby little girl sometimes found rolling under a table with a wet dog or chasing a peddler down the street.
I would like to talk to you, Alice says, if you have time for me.
Of course, he says, taking her arm, folding her hand in his. Thomas Rotherham turns pale, which puzzles him, and slides away.
Alice sits down in his office. She yawns.
Excuse me,
but she is hard work and the hours are long. She tucks a strand of hair into her hood.
She's ready to break, she says. She is brave to your face, but she cries at night because she knows she is a fraud. And even while she is crying, she peeps under her eyelids to see what effect she's making.
I want it over with now, he says, for all the trouble she has caused. We do not find ourselves an edifying spectacle, three or four of us learned in the law and the scriptures, convening day after day to try to trip one chit of a girl.
Why did you not bring her in before?
I didn't want her to shut the prophecy shop. I wanted to see who would come to her whistle. And Lady Exeter has, and Bishop Fisher, and a score of monks and foolish priests whose names I know, and 100 perhaps whose names I don't know yet.
And will the king kill them all?
Very few, I hope.
You incline him to mercy?
I incline him to patience.
What will happen to her, Dame Eliza?
We will frame charges.
She will not go in a dungeon.
No. I shall move the king to treat her with consideration. He is usually, respectful of any person in the religious life. But, Alice, he sees that she is dissolving into tears, I think this has all been too much for you.
No, not at all. We are soldiers in your army.
She's not been frightening you, talking about the devil's wicked offers?
No. It's Thomas Rotherham's offers. He wants to marry me.
So that's what's wrong with him. He's amused. Could he not ask himself?
He thought he would look at him in that way you have, as if you were weighing him.
Like a clipped coin. Alice, he owns a fat slice of Bedfordshire, and his manners prosper very nicely since I have been looking after them. And if you like each other, how could I object? You are a clever girl, Alice. Your mother, he says softly, and your father, they would be very pleased with you, if they were able to see. This is why Alice is crying. She must ask her uncle's permission because this last year has left her orphaned. The day his sister Bet died, he was up country with the king. Henry was receiving no messages from London for fear of contagion, so she was dead and buried before he knew she was ill. When the news crept through at last, the king spoke to him with tenderness, a hand on his arm. He spoke of his own sister, the silver-haired lady like a princess in a book, removed from this life to gardens of paradise he had claimed, reserved for royal dead. For it is impossible, he had said, to think of that lady in any low place, any place of darkness, the barred charnel house of purgatory, with its flying cinders and sulphur reek, its boiling tar and roiling clouds of sleet. Alice, he says, dry your tears. Find Thomas Rotherham and end his pain. You need not come to Lambeth tomorrow. Jo can come, if she is as formidable as you say.
Alice turns in the doorway. I will see her again, though, Eliza Barton. I should like to see her before
they kill her. Alice is no innocent in this world, just as well. Look how the innocent end. Used by the sin-sodden and the cynical, pulped to their purpose and ground under their heels. He hears Alice running upstairs. He hears her calling, Thomas, Thomas. It is a name that will bring half the house out, tumbling from their bedside prayers, from their very beds. Yes, are you looking for me? He pulls his furred gown around him and goes outside to look at the stars. The precincts of his house are kept well lit. The gardens by torchlight are the site of excavations. Trenches dug out for foundations, earth banked up into barrows and mounds. The vast timber frame of a new wing juts against the sky. In the middle distance, his new planting, a city orchard where Gregory one day will pick the fruit, and Alice and Alice's sons. He has fruit trees already, but he wants cherries and plums like the ones he has eaten abroad, and late pears to use in the Tuscan fashion to match their crisp metallic flesh with winter's salt cod. Then next year he means to make another garden at the hunting lodge he has at Canterbury, make it a retreat from the city, a summer house in the fields. He has work in hand at Stepney too, expansion. John Williamson is looking after the builders for him. Strange, but like a miracle, the family's prosperity seems to have cured him of his killing cough. I like John Williams, he thinks. Why ever did I with his wife? Beyond the gate, cries and shouts. London never still or quiet. So many in the graveyards, but the living parading in the streets. Drunken fighters pitching from London Bridge. Sanctuary men stealing out to thieve. Southwark whores bawling out their prices like butchers selling dead flesh. He goes inside. His desk draws him back. In a small chest, he keeps his wife's book, her book of hours. Inside it are prayers on loose papers which he has inserted. Say the name of Christ 1,000 times, and it keeps fever away. But it doesn't, does it? The fever comes anyway and kills you. Beside the name of her first husband, Thomas Williams, she has written his own name. But she never, he notices, crossed Tom Williams out. She has recorded the births of her children, and he has written in beside them the dates of his daughter's deaths. He finds a space where he will note the marriages of his sister's children, Richard to Francis Murfin, Alice to his ward. He thinks, perhaps I have got over Liz. It didn't seem possible that weight would ever shift from inside his chest. But it has lightened enough to let him get on with his life. I could marry again, he thinks. But is this not what people are always telling me? He says to himself, I never think of Joanne Williamson now. Not Joanne she was for me. Her body once had special meaning, but that meaning is now unmade. The flesh created beneath his fingertips, hallowed by desire, becomes just the ordinary substance of a city wife, a fading woman with no particular looks. He says to himself, I never think of Anselma now. She's just the woman in the tapestry, the woman in the weave. He reaches for his pen. I have got over Liz, he says to himself. Surely. He hesitates, the quill in his hand, weighted by ink. He holds the pages down flat and strikes out the name of her first husband. He thinks, I've meant to do that for years. It is late. Upstairs he closes the shutter, where the moon gapes in hollow-eyed, like a drunk lost in the street. Christoph, folding garments, says, Is there loo in this kingdom? I think the wolves all died when the great forests were cut down. That howling you hear is only the Londoners. Sunday. In rose-tinted light, they set out from Austin Friars, his men in their new livery of grey marble cloth, collecting the party from the city house where the nun has been held. It would be convenient, he thinks, if I had Master Secretary's barge instead of making ad hoc arrangements when we have to cross the river. He has already heard Mass. Cranmer insists they all hear another. He watches the girl and sees her tears flow. Alice is right. She is at the end of her invention. By 9 o'clock, she's unwinding the threads she has spent years revelling up. She confesses in style, so hard and fast that rich can hardly keep track, and she appeals to them as men of the world, as people with their way to make. You know how it is. You mention something and people are at you. And what do you mean? What do you mean? You say you've had a vision and they won't leave you alone. You can't disappoint people, he says. She agrees, that's it, you can't. Once you start, you have to keep going. If you try to go back, they'll slaughter you. She confesses that her visions are inventions. She never spoke to heavenly persons or raised the dead. That was all a fraud. She never had a hand in miracles. The letter from Mary Magdalene, Father Bocking wrote it, and a monk put gilding on the letters. In a minute she'll think of his name. The angels came out of her own invention. She seemed to see them, but she knows now they were just flashes of light against the wall. The voices she heard were not their voices. They were not distinct voices at all, just the sounds of her sisters singing in the chapel, or a woman in the road crying because she's been beaten and robbed, or perhaps the meaningless clatter of dishes from the kitchen, and those groans and cries that seemed to come from the throats of the damned. It was someone above scraping a trestle across the floor. It was the whimper of a lost dog. I know now, sirs, that those saints were not real, not in the way you are real. Something has broken inside her, and he wonders what that thing is. She says, Is there any chance I could go home again to Kent? I'll see what can be arranged. Hugh Latimer is sitting with them, and he gives him a hard look, as if he's making false promises. No, really, he says, leave it with me. Cranmer tells her gently,
Before you can go anywhere, it will be necessary for you to make public acknowledgement of your imposture, public confession.
She's not shy of crowds, are you? These many years she's been on the road, a travelling show, and will be again, though now the nature of the show has changed. He means to display her, repentant at Paul's Cross, and perhaps outside London too. He feels that she will take to the role of fraud with the same relish with which she took to her role as saint. He says to Rich, Niccolo tells us unarmed prophets always fail. He smiles and says, I mention this, Ricardo, because I know you like to have it by the book. Cranmer leans forward and says to the maid, These men about you, Edward Bocking and the rest, which of them were your lovers? She is shocked. Perhaps because the question has come from him, the sweetest of her interrogators. She just stares at him, as if one of them was stupid. He says, murmuring, She may think lovers is not the word. Enough. To Audley, to Latimer, to Rich, he says, I shall begin bringing in her followers and her leaders. She has ruined many, if we care to press for their ruin. Fisher, certainly. Margaret Pole, perhaps, Gertrude and her husband for sure, Lady Mary, the king's daughter, quite possibly, Thomas More, no, Catherine, no, but a fat hall of Franciscans. The court rises, if court is what you call it. Jo stands up. She's been sewing, or rather unsewing, teasing out the pomegranate border from a cruel work panel. These remnants of Catherine of the dusty kingdom of Granada linger in England still. She folds her work, dropping her scissors into her pocket, pinching up her sleeve and feeding her needle into the fabric for later use. She walks up to the prisoner and puts a hand on her arm. We must say adieu. William Hawkehurst, the girl says. I remember the name now, the monk who gilded the letter from Mary Magdalene. Richard Rich makes a note. Do not say any more today, Joe advises. Will you come with me, mistress, where I am going? Nobody will come with you, Joe says. I do not think you have the sense of it, Dame Eliza. You are going to the tower, and I am going home to my dinner. This summer of 1533 has been a summer of cloudless days, of strawberry feasts in London gardens, the drone of fumbling bees, warm evenings to stroll under rose arbours, and hear from the alleys the sound of young gentlemen quarrelling over their bowls. The grain harvest is abundant even in the north. The trees are bowed under the weight of ripening fruit. As if he has decreed that the heat must continue, the king's court burns bright through the autumn. Monseigneur, the queen's father, shines like the sun, and around him spins a smaller but still blazing noonday planet, his son, George Rochford. But it is Brandon who leads the dancing, galloping through the halls, towing his new bride, whose age is 14. She is an heiress, and was betrothed to his son, but Charles thought an experienced man like him could turn her to better use. The Seymours have put their family scandal behind them, and their fortunes are mending. Jane Seymour says to him, looking at her feet, "Master Cromwell, my brother Edward smiled last week." "That was rash of him. What made him do so?"
"He heard his wife is sick. The wife he used to have. The one that my father, you know."
"Is she likely to die?"
"Oh, very likely. Then he will get a new one. But he will keep her at his house in Elvetham, and never let her come within a mile of Wolf Hall. And when my father visits Elvetham, she will be locked in the linen room till he's gone again."
Jane's sister Lizzie's at court with her husband, the Governor of Jersey, who is some connection of the new Queen's. Lizzie comes packaged into her velvet and lace, her outlines, as firm as her sister's, are indefinite and blurred, her eyes bold and hazel and eloquent. Jane whispers in her wake. Her eyes are the colour of water, where her thoughts slip past like gilded fishes too small for hook or net. It is Jane Rochford, whose mind, in his view, is under-occupied, who sees him watching the sisters. "Lizzie Seymour must have a lover," she says. "It cannot be her husband who puts that glow in her cheeks. He is an old man. He was old when he was in the Scots Wars." "The two sisters are just a little alike," she points out. "They have the same habit of dipping their head and drawing in their underlip. Otherwise," she says, smirking, "you would think their mother had been up to the same tricks as her husband. She was a beauty in her day, you know, Marjorie Wentworth. And nobody knows what goes on down in Wiltshire."
"I'm surprised you don't, Lady Rochford. You seem to know everyone's business."
"You and me, we keep our eyes open." She lowers her head and says, as if directing the words inward to her own body, "I could keep my eyes open, if you like, in places you cannot go."
Dear God, what does she want? It can't be money, surely. The question comes out colder than he means. Upon what possible inducement?
She lifts her eyes to his.
"I should like your friendship."
"No conditions attached to that."
"I thought I might help you, because your ally, Lady Carey, has gone down to Hever now to see her daughter. She is no longer wanted since Annie's back on duty in the bedchamber. Poor Mary," she laughs. "God dealt her a good enough hand, but she never knew how to play it. Tell me, what will you do if the Queen does not have another child?"
"There is no reason to fear it. Her mother had a child a year. Boleyn used to complain it kept him poor."
"Have you ever observed that when a man gets a son, he takes all the credit, and when he gets a daughter, he blames his wife? And if they do not breed at all, we say it is because her womb is barren. We do not say it is because his seed is bad."
"It's the same in the Gospels. The stony ground gets the blame. The stony places, the thorny, unprofitable waste." Jane Rochford is childless after 7 years of marriage.
"I believe my husband wishes I would die," she says it lightly.
He does not know how to answer. He has not asked for her confidence.
"If I do die," she says, in the same bright tone, "have my body opened. I ask you this in friendship. I am afraid of poison. My husband and his sister are closeted together for hours, and Anne knows all manner of poisons. She has boasted that she will give Mary a breakfast she will not recover from." He waits. "Mary, the king's daughter, I mean, though I am sure if it pleased Anne, she would not scruple to make way with her own sister." She glances up again. "In your heart, if you are honest, you would like to know the things I know."
She is lonely, he thinks, and breeding a savage heart, like Leontina in her cage. She imagines everything is about her, every glance or secret conversation. She is afraid the other women pity her and she hates to be pitied. He says, "What do you know of my heart?"
"I know where you have disposed it."
"It is more than I know myself."
"That is not uncommon among men. I can tell you who you love. Why do you not ask for her if you want her? The Seymours are not rich. They will sell you Jane and be glad of the bargain."
"You are mistaken in the nature of my interest. I have young gentlemen in my house. I have wards. Their marriages are my business."
"Oh, fa-la-la," she says. "Sing another song. Tell it to infants in the nursery. Tell it to the House of Commons. You do most usually lie to them. But do not think you can deceive me."
"For a lady who offers friendship, you have rough manners."
"Get used to them, if you want my information. You go into Anne's rooms now, and what do you see? The Queen at her prie-dieu. The Queen sewing a smock for a beggar woman, wearing pearls the size of chickpeas."
It is hard not to smile. The portrait is exact. Anne has Cranmer entranced. He thinks her the pattern of pious womanhood.
"So, do you imagine that is what is really going on? Do you imagine she has given up communing with nimble young gentlemen? Riddles and verses and songs in praise of her? Do you suppose she has given them up?"
"She has the king to praise her.
Not a good word will she hear from that quarter till her belly is big again."
"And what will hinder that?"
"Nothing, if he's up to it."
"Be careful," he smiles.
"I never knew it was treason to say what passes in a prince's bed. All Europe talked about Catherine. What body part was put where? Was she penetrated? And if she was, did she know?" She sniggers. "Harry's leg pains him at night. He's afraid the Queen will kick him in the throes of her passion."
She puts her hand before her mouth, but the words creep out, narrow between her fingers.
"But if she lies still under him," he says, "what, madam, are you so little interested in making my heir?"
"I do not see what she is to do."
"She says she gets no pleasure with him, and he, as he fought 7 years to get her, he can hardly admit it as stale so soon. It was stale before they came from Calais. That is what I think."
"It's possible. Maybe they were battle-weary, exhausted. Yet he gives her such magnificent presents. And they quarrel so much. Would they quarrel so much if they were indifferent?"
"So," she goes on, "between the kicking and the sore leg, and his lack of prowess and her lack of desire, it will be a wonder if we ever have a Prince of Wales. Oh, he is good man enough, if he had a new woman each week. If he craves novelty, who is to say she does not? Her own brother is in her service."
He turns to look at her. "God help you, Lady Rochford," he says.
"To fetch his friends her way, I mean. What do you think I meant?"
A little grating laugh. "Do you know what you mean yourself? You have been at court long enough. You know what games are played. It is no matter if any lady receives verses and compliments, even though she is married. She knows her husband writes verses elsewhere."
"Oh, she knows that. At least I know. There is not a minx within 30 miles who has not had a set of Rochford's verses. But if you think the gallantry stops at the bedchamber's door, you are more innocent than I took you for. You may be in love with Seymour's daughter, but you need not emulate her in having the wit of a sheep."
He smiles. "Sheep are maligned in that way. Shepherds say they can recognise each other. They answer to their names. They make friends for life."
"And I will tell you who is in and out of everyone's bedchamber. It is that sneaking little boy, Mark. He is the go-between for them all. My husband pays him in pearl buttons and comfit boxes and feathers for his hat."
"Why is Lord Rochford short of ready money?"
"You see an opportunity for usury."
"How not?" "At least, he thinks, there is one point on which we concur. Pointless dislike of Mark. In Wolsey's house he had duties, teaching the choir children. Here he does nothing but stand about, wherever the court is, in greater or lesser proximity to the Queen's apartments. "Well, I can see no harm in the boy," he says.
He sticks like a burr to his betters. He does not know his place. He is a jumped-up nobody, taking his chance because the times are disordered.
"I suppose you could say the same for me, Lady Rochford, and I'm sure you do." Thomas Wyatt brings him baskets of cobnuts and filberts, bushels of Kentish apples, jolting up himself to Austin Friars on the carrier's cart. "The venison follows," he says, jumping down. "I come with the fresh fruit, not the carcasses." His hair smells of apples, his clothes are dusty from the road. "Now you will have words with me," he says, "for risking a doublet worth the carrier's yearly earnings." Wyatt looks chastened. "I forget you are my father. I have rebuked you, so now we can fall to idle boyish talk." Standing in a wash of cherry autumn sun, he holds an apple in his hand. He pares it with a thin blade, and the peel whispers away from the flesh and lies among his papers, like the shadow of an apple, green on white paper and black ink. "Did you see Lady Carey when you were in the country?"
"Mary Boleyn in the country? What do you fresh pleasures spring to mind? I expect she's rutting in some hayloft."
"Just that I want to keep hold of her for the next time her sister is hors de combat."
Wyatt sits down amid the files, an apple in his hand. "Cromwell, suppose you'd been away from England for 7 years. If you'd been like a knight in a story lying under an enchantment, you would look around and wonder, who are they, these people?"
This summer, Wyatt vowed he would stay down in Kent. He would read and write on wet days, hunt when it is fine. But the fall comes and the nights deepen, and Anne draws him back and back. His heart is true, he believes, and if she is false, it is difficult to pick where the falsehood lies. You cannot joke with Anne these days, you cannot laugh. You must think her perfect, or she will find some way to punish you.
"My old father talks about King Edward's days. He says, you see now why it's not good for the king to marry a subject, an Englishwoman.
The trouble is, though Anne has remade the court, there are still people who knew her before, in the days when she came from France, when she set herself to seduce Harry Percy. They compete to tell stories of how she is not worthy, or not human, how she is a snake, or a swan. Una candida cerva. One single white doe, concealed in leaves of silver grey. Shivering, she hides in the trees, waiting for the lover who will turn her back from animal to goddess. Send me back to Italy, Wyatt says. Her dark, her lustrous, her slanting eyes. She haunts me. She comes to me in my solitary bed at night.
Solitary? I don't think so.
Wyatt laughs. You're right. I take it where I can.
You drink too much. Water your wine.
Could have been different.
Everything could.
You never think about the past?
I never talk about it.
Wyatt pleads. Send me away somewhere.
I will, when the king needs an ambassador.
Is it true that the Medici have offered for the Princess Mary's hand?
Not Princess Mary, you mean the Lady Mary. I've asked the king to think about it. But they're not grand enough for him. You know, if Gregory showed any interest in banking, I would look for a bride for him in Florence. It would be pleasant to have an Italian girl in the house.
Send me back there. Deploy me where I can be useful, to you or the king, as here I am useless and worse than useless to myself, and necessary to no one's pleasure.
He says, Oh, by the bleached bones of Becket, stop feeling sorry for yourself.
Norfolk has his own view of the Queen's friends. He rattles a little while he expresses it, his relics clinking, his grey, disordered eyebrows working over wide-open eyes. These men, he says, these men who hang around with women. Norris, I thought better of him, and Henry Wyatt's son, writing verse, singing, talk, talk, talking.
What's the use of talking to women? He asks earnestly. Cromwell, you don't talk to women, do you? I mean, what would be the topic? What would you find to say?
I'll speak to Norfolk, he decides when he comes back from France. Ask him to incline Anne to caution. The French are meeting the Pope in Marseille, and in default of his own attendance, Henry must be represented by his most senior peer. Gardiner is already there. For me, every day is like a holiday, he says to Tom Wyatt, when there's two away. Wyatt says, I think Henry may have a new interest by then. In the days following, he follows Henry's eyes as they rest on various ladies of the court. Nothing in them, perhaps, except the speculative interest of any man. It's only Cranmer who thinks that if you look twice at a woman, you have to marry her. He watches the king dancing with Lizzie Seymour, his hand lingering on her waist. He sees Anne watching, her expression cold, pinched. Next day, he lends Edward Seymour some money on very favourable terms. In the damp autumn mornings, when it is still half light, his household are out early in the damp and dripping woods. You don't get torta di funghi unless you pick the raw ingredients. Richard Rich arrives at 8 o'clock, his face astonished and alarmed. They stopped me at your gate, sir, and said, Where's your bag of mushrooms? No one comes in here without mushrooms. Richard's dignity is affronted. I don't think they would have asked the Lord Chancellor for mushrooms. Oh, they would, Richard. But in an hour you will eat them with eggs baked in cream, and the Lord Chancellor will not. Shall we get down to work? Through September, he has been rounding up the priests and monks who have been close to the maid. He and Sir Purse sift the papers and conduct the interrogations. The clerics are no sooner under lock and key than they begin to deny her and deny each other. I never believed in her. It was Father so-and-so who convinced me. I never wanted any trouble. As for their contacts with Exeter's wife, with Catherine, with Mary, each disclaims his own involvement and rushes to implicate his brother in Christ. The maid's people have been in constant contact with the Exeter household. She herself has been at many of the chief monastic houses of the realm. Sion Abbey, the Charterhouse at Sheen, the Franciscan house at Richmond. He knows this because he has many contacts among disaffected monks. In every house there are a few, and he seeks out the most intelligent. Catherine herself has not met the nun. Why should she? She has Fisher to act as a go-between, and Gertrude, Lord Exeter's wife. The king says, It is hard for me to believe Henry Courtenay would betray me. A garter knight, a great man in the lists, my friend since I was a boy. Wolsey tried to part us, but I wouldn't have it. He laughs. Brandon, do you remember Greenwich, that Christmas? Which year was it? Remember the snowball fight? This is the whole difficulty of dealing with them. Men who are always talking about ancient pedigrees and boyhood friendships and things that happened when he was still trading wool on the Antwerp Exchange. You put the evidence under their noses and they start getting teary over snowball fights. Look, Henry says, It is Courtney's wife that is to blame. When he knows the whole of her practices, he will want to be rid of her. She is fickle and weak like all her sex, easily led into scheming. So forgive her, he says. Write her a pardon. Put these people under a debt of gratitude to you, if you want them to leave off their foolish sentiment towards Catherine. You think you can buy hearts? Charles Brandon says. He sounds as if he would be sad if the answer were yes. He thinks the heart is like any other organ. You can weigh it on a scale. It is not a price in money we are offering. I have enough to put the Courtney family on trial, all Exeter's people. If we forbear to do it, we are offering their freedom and their lands. We are giving them a chance to recoup the honour of their name. Henry says, His grandfather left Crookbank for my father's service. If we forgive them, they will play us for fools, Charles says. I think not, my lord. Everything they do from now on, they do under my eye. And the Poles, Lord Montague, what do you propose there? He should not assume he will be pardoned. Make him sweat, eh? Charles says. I'm not sure I like your way of dealing with noblemen. They get their deserts, the king says. Hush, my lord, I need to think. A pause.
Brandon's position is too complicated for him to sustain. He wants to say, pay them out as traitors, Cromwell. But mind you butcher them respectfully. Suddenly his face clears.
Ah, now I remember Greenwich. The snow was knee-deep that year. Ah, we were young then, Harry. You don't get snow any more, like you did when we were young.
He gathers up his papers and begs to be excused. Reminiscence is setting in for the afternoon, and there is work to be done. Rafe, ride over to West Horsley. Tell Exeter's wife the king thinks all women fickle and weak, though I should have thought he has plenty of evidence to the contrary. Tell her to set down in writing that she has not the wit of a flea. Tell her to claim she is exceptionally easy to mislead, even for a woman. Tell her to grovel. Advise her on the wording. You know how to do it. Nothing can be too humble for Henry. This is the season for humility. The word from the talks in Marseille is that King Francis has fallen at the Pope's feet and kissed his slippers. When the news comes, Henry bellows in obscenity and shreds the dispatch in his hands. He collects up the pieces, lays it out on a table and reads it. "Francis has kept faith with you after all," he says, surprisingly. He has persuaded the Pope to suspend his bull of excommunication. England has a breathing space. "I wish Pope Clement in his grave," Henry says. "God knows he's a man of filthy life, and he's always ailing, so he ought to die. Sometimes," he says, "I pray that Catherine might be translated into glory. Is that wrong?" "If you snap your fingers, Majesty, 100 priests will come running to tell you right from wrong." "It seems I prefer to hear it from you." Henry broods in a sulky, twitching silence. "If Clement dies, who will be the next rogue in office?" "I put my money on Alessandro Farnese."
"Really?"
Henry sits up.
"One lays bets."
"But the odds are short. He has thrown about such bribes to the Roman mob all these years that they will put the cardinals in terror when the time comes.
Remind me, how many children has he?"
4 I know of." The king is looking into the tapestry on the near wall, where white-shouldered women walk barefoot on a carpet of spring flowers.
"I may have another child soon."
"The queen has spoken to you?"
"Not yet."
But he sees, we all do, the flare of colour in Anne's cheeks, the silk sleekness of her person, the tone of command ringing in her voice as she hands out favours and rewards the people around her. This last week, there are more rewards than black looks, and Stephen Vaughan's wife, who is in the bedchamber, says she has missed her courses. The king says,
"She has missed her..."
And then he stops, blushing like a schoolboy. He crosses the room, flings open his arms and embraces him, shining like a star, his great hands with their blazing rings seizing handfuls of the black velvet of his jacket.
"This time for sure! England is ours!"
Archaic, that cry from his heart. As if he were standing on the battlefield between the blooded banners, the crown in a thorn bush, his enemies dead at his feet. He disengages himself gently, smiling. He uncrumples the memorandum he had clenched in his fist when the king seized him. Because is that not how men embrace? They knead each other with big fists, as if to knock each other down. Henry squeezes his arm and says,
"Thomas, it's like hugging a seawall. What are you made of?"
He takes the paper. He gulps.
"Is this what we must do this morning, this list?"
"Not more than 50 items we shall soon work through." For the rest of the day he cannot stop smiling. Who cares for Clement and his bulls? He might as well stand on cheap and let the populace pelt him. He might as well stand under the Christmas garlands, which we dust with flour in years when there is no snow, and sing, "Hey, nonny, no, fa-la-la, under the trees so green-o." On a cold day towards the end of November, the maid and half a dozen of her principal supporters do penance at Paul's Cross. They stand shackled and barefoot in a whipping wind.
The crowd is large and boisterous, the sermon lively, telling what the maid did on her night walks when her sisters in religion were sleeping, and what lurid tales of devils she told to keep her followers in awe. Her confession is read out, at the end of which she asks the Londoners to pray for her and begs for the king's mercy. You wouldn't know her now for the bonny girl they had at Lambeth. She looks haggard and 10 years older. Not that she has been hurt. He would not countenance that for a woman. And in fact, they have all talked without duress. The hard thing has been to stop them complicating the story by rumours and fantasies, so that half England is dragged into it. The one priest who had persistently lied, he had simply locked up with an informer. The man was detained for murder, and in no time at all Father Rich had set about saving his soul and interpreting to him the maid's prophecies and impressing him with the names of important people he knew at court. Pitiful, really. But it has been necessary to put on this show, and next he will take it to Canterbury, so Dame Elizabeth can confess on her home ground. It is necessary to break the hold of these people who talk of the end times and threaten us with plagues and damnation. It is necessary to dispel the terror they create. Thomas More is there, jostled among the city dignitaries. He's making towards him now, as the preachers step down and the prisoners are being led from the platform. More rubs his cold hands. He blows on them. Her crime is she was made use of. He thinks, why did Alice let you out without your gloves? For all the testimony I've got, he says, I still cannot understand how she arrived here from the edge of the marshes to a public scaffold at Paul's. For sure, she made no money out of it. How will you frame the charges? His tone is neutral, interested, lawyer to lawyer. The common law does not deal with women who say they can fly or raise the dead. I shall put an act of attainder into Parliament. Treason charges for the principals. The accessories, life imprisonment, confiscation, fines. The king will be circumspect, I think. Even merciful. I'm more interested in unravelling the plans of these people than exacting penalties. I don't want a trial with scores of defendants and hundreds of witnesses, tying the courts up for years. Moore hesitates. Come on, he says. You would have seen them off that way yourself when you were Chancellor. You may be right. I am clear anyway. A pause. Moore says, Thomas, in the name of Christ, you know that. As long as the king knows it. We must keep it firmly in his mind. A letter from you, perhaps, inquiring after the Princess Elizabeth. I can do that. Making it plain you accept her rights and title. That is not a difficulty. The new marriage is made and must be accepted. You don't think you could bring yourself to praise it? Why does the king want other men to praise his wife? Suppose you were to write an open letter, to say that you have seen the light in the matter of the king's natural jurisdiction over the church. He looks across to where the prisoners are being loaded into the waiting carts. They're taking them back to the tower now. He pauses. You mustn't stand about. Come home with me to dinner. No, Moore shakes his head. I would rather be blown around on the river and go home hungry. If I could trust you only to put food in my mouth, but you will put words into it. He watches him melt into the crowd of home-going aldermen. He thinks, Moore is too proud to retreat from his position. He's afraid to lose his credibility with the scholars in Europe. We must find some way for him to do it that doesn't depend on abjection. The sky has cleared now to a flawless lapis blue. The London gardens are bright with berries. There is an obdurate winter ahead, but he feels a force ready to break. A spring breaks from the dead tree. As the word of God spreads, the people's eyes are open to new truths. Until now, like Helen Barr, they knew Noah and the flood, but not St. Paul. They could count over the sorrows of our blessed mother and say how the damned are carried down to hell. But they did not know the manifold miracles and sayings of Christ, nor the words and deeds of the apostles, simple men who, like the poor of London, pursued simple wordless trades. The story is much bigger than they ever thought it was. He says to his nephew Richard, "You cannot tell people just part of the tale and then stop, or just tell them the parts you choose. They have seen their religion painted on the walls of churches or carved in stone. But now God's pen is poised, and he is ready to write his words in the books of their hearts." But in these same streets, Chapuis sees the stirrings of sedition, a city ready to open its gates to the emperor. He was not at the sack of Rome, but there are nights when he dreams of it, as if he had been there, the black guts spilled on antique pavements, the half-dead draped in the fountains, the chiming of bells through the marsh fog, the flames of arsonists' torches leaping along the walls. Rome has fallen, and everything within it. It was not invaders, but Pope Julius himself, who knocked down old St. Peter's, which had stood for 1,200 years, the site where the Emperor Constantine himself had dug the first trench, 12 scoops of soil, one for each of the apostles, where the Christian martyrs, sown into the skins of wild beasts, had been torn apart by dogs. 25 feet he dug down to lay his new foundations, through a necropolis, through 12 centuries of fish bones and ash, his workmen's shovels powdering the skulls of saints. In the place where martyrs had bled, ghost white boulders stood, marble, waiting for Michelangelo. In the street, he sees a priest carrying the host, no doubt to a dying Londoner. The passers-by uncover their heads and kneel, but a boy leans out of an upper window and jeers, "Show us your Christ is risen! Show us your jack-in-the-box!" He glances up. The boy's face, before it vanishes, is vivid with rage. He says to Cranmer, "These people want a good authority, one they can properly obey. For centuries, Rome has asked them to believe what only children could believe. Surely they will find it more natural to obey an English king, who will exercise his powers under Parliament and under God." 2 days after he sees More, shivering at the sermon, he conveys a pardon to Lady Exeter. It comes with some blistering words from the king, directed to her husband. It is St. Catherine's Day, in honour of the saint who was threatened with martyrdom on a wheel. We all walk in circles to our destination. At least, that's the theory. He has never seen anyone over the age of 12 actually doing it. There's a feeling of power in reserve, a power that drives right through the bone, like the shiver you sense in the shaft of an axe when you take it into your hand. You can strike, or you cannot strike. And if you choose to hold back the blow, you can still feel inside you the resonance of the omitted thing. Next day at Hampton Court, the king's son, the Duke of Richmond, marries Norfolk's daughter, Mary. Anne has arranged this marriage for the glorification of the Howards, also to stop Henry marrying his bastard to the boy's advantage to some princess abroad. She has persuaded the king to waive the magnificent dower payment he would have expected, and triumphant in all her designs, she joins the dancing, her thin face flushed, her shining hair braided with dagger tips of diamonds. Henry cannot take his eyes off her, and nor can he. Richmond draws to him all other eyes, gambling like a colt, showing off his wedding finery, turning, leaping, bouncing and strutting. "Look at him," the older ladies say, "and you will see how his father was once, that perfect glow, skin as thin as a girl's." "Master Cromwell," he demands, "tell the king, my father, that I want to live with my wife. He says that I am to go back to my household, and Mary is to stay with the queen."
"He has a care for your health, my lord."
"I am 15 next."
"It wants half a year till your birthday."
The boy's blithe expression vanishes. A stony look takes over his face. "Half a year is nothing. A man of 15 is competent."
"So we hear," Lady Rochford says, standing idly by. "The king, your father, brought witnesses to court to say his brother could do the deed at 15, and more than once a night."
"It is also your bride's health that we need to think of."
"Brandon's wife is younger than mine, and he has her." "Every time he sees her," Lady Rochford says, if I judge by the startled expression on her face.
Richmond is digging himself in for a long argument, entrenching himself behind precedent. It is his father's way of arguing.
"Did not my great-grandmother, Lady Margaret Beaufort, give birth at 13 years to the prince who will be Henry Tudor?"
"Bosworth, the tattered standards, the bloody field, the stained sheet of maternity. Where do we all come from, he thinks, but this same hole and corner dealing? Sweetheart, yield to me. I never heard it improve her health," he says, "or her temper. She had no children after." Suddenly he is tired of the argument. He cuts it short, his voice tired and flat. "Be reasonable, my lord. Once you've done it, you want to do it all the time, for about 3 years. That's the way it goes. And your father has other work in mind for you. He may send you to hold court in Dublin." Jane Rochford says,
"Be easy, my lamb. There are ways that can be contrived. A man may always meet a woman, if she is willing."
"May I speak as your friend, Lady Rochford? You risk the king's displeasure if you meddle in this."
"Oh," she says easily. "Henry will forgive anything to a pretty woman. They only seek to do what is natural." The boy says, "Why should I live like a monk?" "A monk? They go to it like goats. Master Cromwell here will tell you." "Perhaps," Richmond says, "it is Madame the Queen who wants to keep us apart. She doesn't mean the king to have a grandson in the cradle before he has a son of his own." "But do you not know," Jane Rochford turns to him, "has it not reached your ears that La Anna is enceinte?"
She gives her the name Chapuis gives her. He sees the boy's face open in blank dismay. Jane says,
"I fear by summer you will have lost your place, sweetheart. Once he has a son born in wedlock, you may tup to your heart's content. You will never reign, and your offspring will never inherit." It isn't often that you see a princeling's hopes destroyed in the instant it takes to pinch out a candle flame,
and with the same calculated movement as if born of the neatness of habit. She has not even licked her fingers. Richmond says, his face crumpling,
"It may be another girl." "It is almost treason to hope so," Lady Rochford says. "And if it is, she will have a third child and a fourth. I thought she would not conceive again, but I was wrong, Master Cromwell. She has proved herself now."
Cranmer is in Canterbury, walking on a path of sand barefoot to his enthronement as Primate of England. The ceremony done, he's sweeping out the Priory of Christchurch, whose members gave so much encouragement to the false prophetess. It could be a long job, interviewing each monk, picking their stories apart. Roland Lee storms into town to put some brawn into the business, and Gregory is in his train. So he sits in London reading a letter from his son, no longer nor more informative than his schoolboy letters. And now no more for lack of time. He writes to Cranmer, "Be merciful to the community there, as nothing worse than misled. Spare the monk who gilded the Magdalene's letter. I suggest they give a present in cash to the king. £300 will please him. Clean out Christchurch and the whole diocese. Warham was archbishop for 30 years. His family are entrenched. His bastard son is archdeacon. Take a new broom to them. Put in people from home, your sad East Midlands clerks, formed under sober skies." There is something beneath his desk, under his foot, the nature of which he has avoided thinking about. He pushes his chair back. It is half a shrew, a gift from Marlinspike. He picks it up and thinks of Henry Wyatt, eating vermin in his cell. He thinks of the Cardinal,
resplendent at Cardinal College. He throws the shrew on the fire. The corpse fizzes and shrivels, bones gone with an empty little pop. He picks up his pen and writes to Cranmer. Shake out those Oxford men from your diocese and put in Cambridge men we know. He writes to his son. Come home and spend the new year with us. December. In her frozen angularity, a blue light behind her cast up from the snow, Margaret Pole looks as if she has stepped from a church window, slivers of glass shaking from her gown. In fact, those splinters are diamonds. He has made her come to him, the Countess, and now she looks at him from beneath her heavy lids. She looks at him down her long Plantagenet nose, and her greeting, ice-bright, flies out into the room.
Cromwell!
Just that. She comes to business.
The Princess Mary? Why must she quit the house in Essex?
My Lord Rochford wants it for his use. It's good hunting country, you see. Mary is to join her royal sister's household at Hatfield. She will not need her own attendance there.
I offer to support my place in her household at my own expense. You cannot prevent me from serving her.
Try me. I am only the minister of the king's wishes, and you, I suppose, are as anxious as I am to carry them out.
These are the wishes of the concubine. We do not believe, the princess and I, that they are the king's own wishes.
You must stretch your credulity, madam.
She looks down at him from her plinth. She is Clarence's daughter, old King Edward's niece. In her time, men like him knelt down to speak to women like her.
I was in Catherine the Queen's suite on the day she was married. To the princess, I stand as a second mother.
Blood of Christ, madam. You think she needs a second? The one she has will kill her.
They stare at each other across an abyss.
Lady Margaret, if I may advise you, your family's loyalty is suspect.
So you say. This is why you are parting me from Mary, as punishment. If you have matter enough to indict me, then send me to the Tower with Elizabeth Barton.
That would be much against the king's wishes. He reveres you, madam, your ancestry, your great age.
He has no evidence.
In June last year, just after the Queen was crowned, your son, Lord Montague, and your son, Geoffrey Pole, dined with Lady Mary. Then a scant 2 weeks later, Montague dined with her again. I wonder what they discussed.
Do you really?
No, he says, smiling. The boy who carried in the dish of asparagus, that was my boy. The boy who sliced the apricots was mine too. They talked about the Emperor, about the invasion, how he might be brought to it. So you see, Lady Margaret, all your family owes much to my forbearance. I trust they will repay the king with future loyalty. He does not say, I mean to use your sons against their troublemaking brother abroad. He does not say, I have your son Geoffrey on my payroll. Geoffrey Pole is a violent, unstable man. You do not know how he will turn. He has paid him £40 this year to turn the Cromwell way. The Countess curls her lip.
The Princess will not leave her home quietly.
My Lord of Norfolk intends to ride to Beaulieu, to tell her of the change in her circumstances. She may defy him, of course.
He had advised the King, leave Mary in possession of her style as Princess, do not diminish anything. Do not give her cousin, the Emperor, a reason to make war.
Henry had shouted, Will you go to the Queen and suggest to her that Mary keep her title? For I tell you, Master Cromwell, I'm not going to do it. And if you put her in a great passion, as you will, and she falls ill and miscarries her child, you will be responsible, and I shall not incline to mercy.
Outside the door of the presence chamber, he leans on the wall. He rolls his eyes and says to Rafe, God in heaven, no wonder the cardinal was old before his time.
If he thinks her peak will dislodge it, he cannot be stuck very fast. Last week I was his brother in arms. This week he is threatening me with a bloody end. Rafe says, "It is a good thing you're not like the Cardinal."
Indeed. The Cardinal expected the gratitude of his prince, in which matter he was bound to be disappointed. For all his capacities, he was a man whose emotions would master him and wear him out. He, Cromwell, is no longer subject to vagaries of temperament, and he's almost never tired. Obstacles will be removed, tempers will be soothed, knots unknotted. Here, at the close of the year 1533, his spirit is sturdy, his will strong, his front imperturbable. The courtiers see that he can shape events, mould them. He can contain the fears of other men and give them a sense of solidity in a quaking world. This people, this dynasty, this miserable rainy island at the edge of the world. By way of recreation at the end of the day, he is looking into Catherine's land holdings and judging what he can redistribute. Sir Nicholas Carew, who does not like him and does not like Anne, is amazed to receive from him a package of grants, including 2 fat Surrey manors to adjoin his existing holdings in the county. He seeks an interview to express his thanks. He has to ask Richard, who keeps the Cromwell diary now, and Richard fits him in after 2 days. As the Cardinal used to say, deference means making people wait. When Carew comes in, he is arranging his face. Chilly, self-absorbed, the complete courtier, he works at turning up the corners of his mouth. The result is a maidenly simper, incongruous above a luxuriant beard. "Oh, I'm sure you are deserving," he says, shrugging it off. "You are a boyhood friend of His Majesty, and nothing gives him greater pleasure than to reward his old friends. Your wife is in touch with the Lady Mary, is she not? They are close. Ask her," he says gently, "to give the young woman good advice. Warn her to be conformable to the king in all things. His temper is short these days, and I cannot answer for the consequences of defiance. Deuteronomy tells us, gifts blind the eyes of the wise. Carew is not particularly wise, in his opinion, but the principle holds good, and if not exactly blinded, at least he looks dazed. Call it an early Christmas present," he tells him, smiling. He pushes the papers across his desk. At Austin Friars, they are cleaning out storerooms and building strongrooms. They will keep the feast at Stepney. The angel's wings are moved there. He wants to keep them till there is another child in the house of the right size. He sees them going, shivering in their shroud of fine linen, and watches the Christmas star loaded onto a cart. Christoph asks, "How would one work it, that savage machine that is all over points?" He draws off one of the canvas sleeves, shows him the gilding. "Jesus Maria," the boy says, "the star that guides us to Bethlehem. I thought it was an engine for torture." Norfolk goes down to Bewley to tell Lady Mary she must move to the manor at Hatfield and be an attendant to the little princess and live under the governance of Lady Anne Shelton, aunt to the Queen. What ensues, he reports back in aggrieved tones. "Aunt to the Queen?" says Mary. "There is but one Queen, and that is my mother."
"Lady Mary," Norfolk says, and the words make her burst into tears and run to her room and lock herself in. Suffolk goes up the country to Buckden to convince Catherine to move to another house. She has heard that they mean to send her somewhere even damper than Buckden, and she says the damp will kill her. So she too shuts herself up, rattling the bolts into place and shouting at Suffolk in 3 languages to go away. She will go nowhere, she says, unless he is prepared to break down the door and bind her with ropes and carry her, which Charles thinks is a little extreme. Brandon sounds so sorry for himself when he writes back to London for instructions.
a man with a bride of 14 awaiting his attentions, to spend the holiday like this. When his letter is read out to the council, he, Cromwell, bursts out laughing. The sheer joy of it carries him into the new year. There is a young woman walking the roads of the kingdom, saying she is the Princess Mary, and that her father has turned her out to beg. She has been seen as far north as York, and as far east as Lincoln, and simple people in these shires are lodging and feeding her, and giving her money to see her on her way. He has people keeping an eye out for her, but they haven't caught her yet. He doesn't know what he would do with her if he did catch her. It is punishment enough to take on the burden of a prophecy, and to be out unprotected on the winter roads. He pictures her, a dun-coloured dwindling figure, tramping away towards the horizon over the flat, muddy fields.
This ends Disc 17.